Hello, I'm Howard. Welcome to 9320 Podcast, and ahead of this weekend's trip to the Palace, I'm delighted to be joined by none other than Kevin Day. Good afternoon, Kevin. How are you doing?
I'm all right, Howard. Thank you very much. I'll probably be better in 24 hours' time when it's out of the way.
Oh.
The City game.
Don't play this game. You did this last time.
Yeah, I didn't quite plan out the way we predicted or any of us expected, to be perfectly honest. But that's what happened. In one of Roy Hodgson's rare fits of enthusiasm, we started trying to score a goal, and lo and behold, we scored a couple of goals. And that's he retreated into his shell after that. I think he went home and his wife told him off for getting overexcited. It didn't happen again.
Got overexcited, did he? Yeah. To be fair, we did a good job of handing you one of those goals right at the end as well, didn't we?
So, you did, you did.
A disaster class. So, yeah. Thanks for taking the time out to speak to me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, mate.
We spoke for an hour last time and it could have gone on for 2 hours, I think. But yeah, you did have a glass of wine with you last time. We're speaking at 3 p.m. on a Friday this time. Too early for a glass of wine, or...?
I'm very responsible in my old age. It's I headed towards the fridge, but then Mrs. Day's eyebrows headed towards the top of her head. So I've got a cup of tea this time, because we are a bit earlier in the afternoon. So even for me, it's a little bit early. I'll be in the pub at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, and I won't think that's way too early to start drinking Guinness. Of course, either, yeah. So,
I'm sure we've all drunk... all had a pint at 5 a.m. in an airport, haven't we? So, time's very fluid. You should have just taken the wine out and said you were going to let it breathe for an hour or two. So.
Well, I didn't think of that. Yeah, it's strange on a, because we all have very fixed routines. Well, most football fans have very fixed routines and habits. So, the fact that we're kicking off at 12:30 tomorrow isn't letting any of us not having our traditional 3 hours in the pub. Well, we always have 3 hours in the pub. So that means we have to get in there at 9:30. Then we have to get in there at 9:30. It's as simple as that. And it's open at 9:30, so it'd be rude not to get in there.
I assume that's a Spoons then.
It's not, no.
No?
No. It's the Pawson's Arms, which is a very... it welcomes away fans, but only because it's impossible for away fans to find, basically. It's a very old... It's not that far from the ground, but it's one of the very few old-fashioned traditional pubs left in South London, and it's a proper Palace pub. The owner's a mad Palace fan, so it's full of Palace memorabilia. So no, that's always where we head before it. As my wife puts it, we head to Dev. We have done for 25 years to talk the same bollocks to the same people sitting at the same table, basically. But that's what increasingly, the older I get, the less important the actual game is. It's the social stuff before and after.
Saturday after 12, I think the earliest is 11 o'clock that pub's open. I know of in the centre of Manchester, which is probably early enough, to be honest, if you're out after the match as well.
Technically, officially and legally, that's the earliest it's supposed to open. But
yeah. Oh, yeah. I obviously haven't learnt the secret knock that could get me in at 10. So. I was going to ask you this later, but do you hate half 12 kickoffs?
Well, I do. I'm old fashioned enough. I love a 3 o'clock kickoff, and I know the reasons for 3 o'clock kickoffs are historical, to do with factory and meal times. I know all that, and I know we're living in the 21st century. But I like the 3 o'clock kickoffs. The only time I like a 12:30 kickoff is when we're playing a really good team, because they do tend to be flatter games, the 12:30 kick. And when we're playing teams like Liverpool, City, Arsenal, I'm quite happy with a 12:30 kickoff in those circumstances, because it normally takes until the second half for the good team to wake up a little bit. So it's I don't think the players like them particularly either. I think their training is so scientifically timed and measured these days that they're geared towards 3 o'clock kickoffs for the most part. So I don't think their body clocks, their circadian rhythms are ready for 12:30 kickoffs either. So no one really likes them, but we have to put up with them because TNT Sport, that's what they get thrown as a bone, isn't it, in the broadcasting deal. They get the odd 12:30 kickoffs, so we have to put up with it, I suppose.
Results kind of key, isn't it? If you win a 12:30, put your feet up for the rest of the weekend and watch the scores come in and that sort of thing and have a drink. So,
well, yeah. there is that. Unfortunately, we haven't got a bad record on Monday nights, but our Saturday kickoff time is a brilliant. For all that I say that the decent away teams, yeah, tend to be flatter at 12:30 on a Saturday. Like I say, by the time it gets to 1:30 on Saturday, they seem to be wide awake.
And the obvious place to start talking Palace, I think, since we last spoke, Roy Hodgson has left. He had a health scare, of course. But that aside, was it kind of an inevitable and correct decision that he left?
Inevitable, I don't know. I think the health decision muddied the waters a little bit.
Yeah, exactly.
To be perfectly honest, I think we all realised that. I really like Roy Hodgson as an individual. He's not happy-go-lucky. He's not laugh a minute, but he's an interesting, fascinating chap. I've interviewed him a few times. I've met him a few times. Anyone like me who's got a passion for the history of football can't fail to be impressed by talking to Roy Hodgson.
Yeah.
But things moved on a little bit. He was, towards the end, we interviewed him just before Christmas for the 500th edition of our Palace pod. He was kind enough to come on for that. And he's a man, he's just disillusioned to say. And I thought it was a mistake to sack Vieira in the first place and to bring Roy Hodgson back. I thought it was a mistake to keep Roy Hodgson as manager. I thought that was a soft option. Mm. I thought we took too long to sack him again this time. Our results were very, very poor for a long period of time. Having said that, there are still Palace fans now, and I understand why, who say that we should have kept him to the end of the season. But any problems we're having now, I think, are down to 4 years of Jurassic Park rather than 6 weeks of Oliver Glasner, basically. Oliver Glasner came in. My understanding is he saw the academy, which is wonderful and state-of-the-art, but then when he asked to meet the coaches, and they said, well, you're looking at them. He went, well, there's only two of them. He said, well, yeah, that's it. He said, where's the set-piece coaches? We haven't got any. Where are the stamina? Wow. Where are the sports scientists? We haven't got many of them. So we were stuck in a rut. And I think it's interesting when you look at Everton under Sean Dyche, you look at Palace under Roy Hodgson. Things have moved on. Football's moved on. And already what you've got at Palace is a much more entertaining brand of football. You can see where we're heading and it's in the right direction. And I for one, am delighted to have one of those continental coaches with white trainers who walks up and down the tunnels. That's what I want. But you're looking at a team who for 4 years have been coached to only play one way of football. And you're looking at a team who are getting used to the idea. For a start, we're playing three centre-backs, which is very different for us. But we're also looking at a team who are being asked to keep the ball better, to progress the ball in possession, to move the ball more quickly than we ever have done. And it's a bit like turning around a super tanker. Our squad are still getting used to that. And I think when new players are brought in, and I think when I think our players are buying into it, they seem to be enjoying themselves more. But, you know, you have to say the results haven't been earth-shattering. But you can see the progress. If you go and see the games, you can see the progress that we're being made. And I for one, am more excited about. I want to get this season out of the way and then let Glasner have a full preseason to see how we're going. But already we look at more modern is the only way I can think of saying it. We look a more modern team. We look a more adaptable, more flexible, modern team who are more willing to go forward. We lack a striker, an instinctive striker. But apart from that, I think the change that's been made was absolutely necessary. And unfortunately, it has led, we're a fan base divided at the moment. It has led, there are still quite a few Roy Hodgson loyalists, the Roy Division, as they're called, that are still, basically, Glasner will have to win the league before the old Roy diehards are won over. But for most of us, we can appreciate what's going on. The change had to be made, Howard. It really, really did have to be made. I think we probably would have stayed up under Hodgson. But the thing, we paid £700 for a season ticket. You want to see at Selhurst Park us trying to win games. And at least that's what we've done so far in the two games under Glasner. We have tried to win. Whether the approach is identical tomorrow, I don't know. But it took Steve Parish a long time to realise that we're paying a lot of money to see a really turgid style of football. So I'm glad that we've taken the decision. I think we're going in the right direction, touch wood.
Well, ticket prices are a touchy subject right now. So have your prices been announced for next season yet?
They have, yeah. Actually, to be fair, Palace have been very good. The prices have been maintained. I think it's only about an 8% price rise for us. I think the big difference will come if our new stand is ever built. I think that's when you might see ticket prices rising considerably. But we've got a very loyal captive audience, for want of a better word. And the club know that they won't get. They did try a massive ticket hike 2 years ago, and they didn't get away with it. So they our ticket prices are fairly reasonable. And also, to be fair, we have got quite a few monthly schemes, so people who can't afford the outlay at the start of the season can pay on a monthly basis. And so it's not an issue for us. Not an issue in the way it is for, I know, for Man City, for Tottenham in particular. What Tottenham are doing, it's taking a concession away for pensioner fans at Spurs. It's just shameful, just shocking piece of work. So Parrish hasn't got that sort of chutzpah, to be perfectly honest. But I think that will change when this mythical new stand is finally built, if it ever is. I think that's when we'll see the 70, 80 pound, the Fulham ticket prices are just ludicrous. But at the moment, ours kind of reflect where we are in the league and where we are in London. You know, it's not
in the country. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Well, mine's gone up to 485, so I should be grateful. Apparently, that. And that's, I guess, that is a bar. That's the second cheapest, I think, in the ground. But it's about the eighth year in a row it's gone up. So
Well, the trouble is with City as well, and Parrish knows this at Palace. It's like, I think we've got a waiting list of about 300. Whereas City know, Arsenal know, Spurs know, Chelsea know, there are 10,000 people. If you don't want your season ticket, there are 10,000 people that will take your season ticket.
They don't. Well, they don't want season tickets. I think they want individual purchases.
This is Kieran Maguire's big theory on the price of football pod, that clubs, because I half jokingly half mentioned the season when I threatened to send my season ticket back, and he said they would love you to do that. They would. Every Premier League club in an ideal world would have, you know, Tottenham would fill that stadium with South Korean fans if they could, because those fans spend a lot more money on a match day basis than I do. It's like, when was the last time you went in the club shop on a match day? When was the last time?
It's moved, and I didn't even know it moved.
Well, there you go.
No, absolutely no need to. My home kits cost about £12, but I can't tell you why that is. Allegedly. So
we can guess why.
Though if they sold them for £40 or £50, I'd be buying them. I'd be going into the club shop. So they've only got themselves to blame, to be honest. But no, I mean, if I sold my individual ticket, it'd be on the City site for about £75. So
yeah, of course.
Absolutely ridiculous. Anyway, I could go off on a real tangent with ticket prices, but you did say wins were few and far between. I did see a fellow Palace fan, I think we played to you, was worried about a relegation battle. You can't really have a fear of that, can you?
It's not so much. It would take an extraordinary set of circumstances for us to be relegated, but it's Palace we're talking about. So this extraordinary set of circumstances could have... even if we were not to get another point this season, which I can't see happening, with the goal difference, which hopefully won't take too much of a knock tomorrow, Luton would still have to win three and draw one of their last seven games, and they haven't won in 11. So there's no real logic in assuming that's going to happen. I hate to say this, but I'm expecting Everton to be deducted more points.
Yeah,
I don't want it to be deducted. So I don't think we will go down, but I think what's so frustrating, Howard, is that yet again, our 12th season in the Premier League, we're going through this, that we're looking over our shoulders rather than looking ahead. We have to put up with Brighton being in Europe. We have to put up with teams like Fulham and Wolves making the sort of progress that we expect to make. And yet again, we haven't done that. And the table doesn't look good. However you look at it, we're going to finish with fewer points. You know, we're top of the bottom, if you like, the table. We hoped for more than that this year, and we need to get more than that eventually. Because, again, coming back to the ticket prices, eventually, if, I mean, I pay 700 quid for mine, which is one that, although I get a discount, to be fair, but that's a lot of money to see your team finish 14th every season and to continually lose to the bigger teams. So we just want to see the progress that we think. It just seems, I mentioned this last time, it just seems, Aaron, that every season, as each season starts in the Premier League, it's like we're a promoted team. It all seems new to us, that it's like we're starting again. And it just, you know, like I say, it's our 12th season. We should be more established than we are.
Would you rather you had to suck a risk then? Yeah.
No, not relegation. I mean, there's a generational thing there. For me, being in the Premier League is enough. Yes, of course it is. I've been through two administrations, but
yeah.
The other aspect to that is if you keep swirling around the plug hole, you will eventually go down the plug hole. And I'm not saying we should spend money we haven't got to try to break into the top six. But what I am saying is it would be nice to have a conversation in January where you look at the league table and you go, oh, we're not going down. So let's see what we can do the rest of the season.
Yeah.
Rather than still, you know, coming up to the middle of April thinking we could go down. So we need to get beyond that. And, you know, the trouble is, I think you've probably got a top seven if you assume that Newcastle will probably never get relegated. But outside of that top seven, just about every club in the Premier League probably will be relegated in the next 10 years or so. But it just would be nice to have a couple of seasons when that's not an issue for us. You know, it's not much of an ambition, but if we could squeak into the Europa Conference, I would do that. I would.
What? 14 other teams get points deductions for failing.
Well, in fact, not this season, but you know, I want to go to Geneva.
Yeah.
To see Palace play.
Places you've never heard of. City played in the Faroe Islands. So.
I want to see us lose to new teams. I want to see new kits. I think that's where the fear about relegation comes in. It's more an existential fear for us this season. I don't think many Palace fans, and I won't say out loud we're not going to get relegated, but I don't think many Palace fans think we will. It's just we're so frustrated by the fact it is still an option. So that's where
every fan wants to see their team play a European competition, don't they?
Of course they do.
It's just so. Yeah. Even playing Football Manager, it's a buzz if you sneak into that conference league, basically. Yeah. And yeah, you'd lose that if you went down, wouldn't you? So
yeah.
The winners of domestic cup still get to Europe? I don't know if they don't do. I don't know.
FA Cup. I think I'm not sure. The sort of thing, if you'd asked me that question when I was 12, I would have told you the answer straight away. And considering I host a football finance pod, I should know the answer to that question. But let's move on and pretend we knew the answer.
Well, let's look on the pitch. You still got a problem conceding late goals as well.
Yeah, St. Palace fans the other night against Bournemouth, who are the form team in the Premier League, and we didn't deserve to lose that game, even with an injury hit team. We didn't deserve to draw up for it. We deserved to beat Forest, and we didn't deserve to lose to a really good Bournemouth side. But that wasn't really, that was just poor defending, to be perfectly honest. It wasn't really a late goal. We have had an issue with conceding late goals, but that's, I think, down to the fact that we haven't got we didn't have proper fitness coaches, and then we didn't have proper sports scientists, because Roy Hodgson was very suspicious of that sort of thing. Roy Hodgson gave the players more days off than any other Premier League manager. The number of injuries we were getting in training makes you wonder what the sort of training was like. I think hopefully the late goals will end when the players' stamina and fitness catches up with what Ole Glasner clearly wants and clearly expected to inherit from a Premier League team.
Has he started bringing in extra staff and behind the scenes big time? Yeah.
We have a much bigger fitness team now. We've got two set-piece specialists, one for defending set-pieces and one for attacking set-pieces, whereas before, Dean Kiely, our goalkeeping coach, was also the set-piece coach. So come 5 o'clock, when the goalkeepers went home, he'd do a bit of set-piece work. and there's a noticeable difference in the imagination and quality of our attacking set pieces. So things are being changed. And from what I can gather from people who work at the club, there's much more emphasis on on stamina rather than fitness, so that we're fit for 110 minutes rather than. Ole Glasner made some rather pointed comments after the Tottenham game away, which was his second game, and for which for 80 minutes we were good. We played really well for 80 minutes, and it was 1-1, and Spurs were getting really frustrated, and you could just see the energy go from the team, and Glasner made some really pointed comments at the end of that game about how any team, you know, we saw the game last night at the Man United Chelsea, said teams have to be prepared to play for 120 minutes in this league, and it might take this season and the close season before we're actually ready for that. And there's also a slight problem as well, because we are playing this, you know, three centre backs, so that's taken a little bit of getting used to as well. But the issue of late goals, I mean, it's been a problem all season. It's been a real problem all season. I'm hoping that will be at least improved by the end of this season. But again, if we happen to be 1-0 up tomorrow against you with 5 minutes to go, no one's going to be betting on a Palace win. Let's put it that way.
Well, let's hope we don't get to that situation to find out. So last time, I mean, what you said at the beginning of this podcast, last time we spoke as well, I'm sure you said you'd bite my hand off to take a 3-0 loss.
Yeah.
How many times do Palace have to take points off City until they go into these games with some confidence?
Isn't it strange as well? Because, I mean, we were 2-0 down against you the game just before Christmas. And when it was 2-0, I was thinking about our conversation, because I was then like, well, 2-0, this is a bonus, only 2-0. Mm. And then we got that rush of blood to the head and started to attack in the last 10 minutes. I'm really interested to see how we play against you tomorrow at home, because our record against you away is better than our record against you at home.
But you've not scored since 2019, which really surprised me. Yeah.
Well, to be fair, there's a lot of teams that can say we haven't scored against them since 2019.
at Salah's part.
This is one of the things that Palace fans got so frustrated with Hodgson, because Bournemouth played us off the pitch. I think it was the game after your game, or the game after. Bournemouth played us off the pitch at Sellers Park. We were terrible. Bournemouth were a much better team than us. And afterwards, Roy made this speech about Palace fans are too ambitious, too optimistic. Mm-hmm. They turn up at Sellers Park expecting to see goals. And that's just not true, because we just don't score goals at Sellers Park. We very rarely score goals. Our scoring record at home is really poor. So I'm intrigued, because we played two home games under Glasner so far, both against teams below us. And we should have scored 10 against Burnley, to be honest. Burnley were abject against us, and we were very, very good in Glasner's first game. We only scored 3 against Luton. Luton equalised in the 97th minute. And, of course, Townsend made the pass for them. But we should have been out of sight against Luton. We should have been 5-0 up before they equalised. So I'll be intrigued to see how he approaches the game tomorrow against City, because I don't think he can be as attack-minded as he was in those two games. And I'm really intrigued that getting 10 men behind the ball now has a name. Now it's called the low block now. I like that, because playing the low block sounds much better than desperately putting 10 men behind the ball and trying to hold on for a point.
But I'll
be interested to see if he does that, because we've got injury problems at centre back, which is an issue when you play three centre backs. We started against Bournemouth with a kid from the academy who came on against you, funnily enough, at Etihad, Ozo, who's a defensive midfield player, and he started at centre back against Bournemouth, which is, you know, if Haaland starts tomorrow, and Tompkins might be playing tomorrow, which is, if Haaland's playing, is a nightmare scenario for us. But we've got our two wing backs, both enjoy going forward much more than they enjoy defending. So I can't see that he'll give them the freedom that he's given them so far. Even in away games, Mitchell and Munoz have really looked to get forward. I can't see him instructing them to do that tomorrow. So I'm really intrigued as to what his approach is tomorrow.
Need to talk about Eze, the star man, surely. Just how good has he been staying fit this season?
But do you know what? Well, that's the problem.
Is he in England squad, by the way?
Not the last one. He got picked in the previous.
And got injured.
Got injured. That's the optimum word with him, is fit. And it's the same with Eze. The thing with Eze is, he's wonderful to watch. He's a joy to watch. We love him to bits. But having said that, the fitness notwithstanding, we discussed this the other night on the way back from work. I can't remember any game in which we've come away thinking Eze grabbed that game by the scruff of the neck and he won that game for us over 90 minutes. He's just not that sort of player. I mean, he's brilliant. He's fantastic. He's creative. He looks like a kid in the playground. He does things you won't expect. But at the same time, he's quite easy to mark. He tends to disappear in games at time. He and Elise, the system we play, I think it's difficult to see him and Elise starting together, the system we're in. Against a team like City, for example, I don't think we could start Elise and Eze together because it would leave us really light in the centre of midfield. And again, Elise does things with the ball that Zaha can do. Elise, for me, has got the potential to be one of the most exciting players we've ever had.
Yeah,
but he only plays one game out of four. And again, he'll have a brilliant 15 minutes and he'll score, I think, three of his goals this season have been goal of the month contenders. One of them won. He will score you brilliant goals. But then at the end of the game, you go, well, hang on. And you compare that to someone like Cole Palmer last night, who was just astonished. I mean, just for the
subjectless.
Well, I understand that, of course it is. But just when Conor Gallagher came to us, for example, we expected him to be that sort of player for a season. And he wasn't. He was brilliant for us. But he never did what Palmer did last night. And that's a piss poor Chelsea team. But he grabbed that game last night by the scruff of the neck, and at every single opportunity he had, he went forward. He won, and it's like Eze won't win a tackle. Elise won't win a tackle. I hesitate to say it. They're not luxury players, and Eze, of course, will always start if he's fit. But it's hard. I don't think we'll keep Eze. I don't think we'll keep Elise. We probably won't keep Gerhi, the centre-back. But I think it will be teams like Man United and Newcastle they go to. I can't even see Arsenal. I don't think City. I don't see where...
Supposedly tried to sign Eze late on in the summer window.
None of us believed that because I don't... He doesn't work hard enough for Guardiola.
I'm surprised. Everyone at this podcast loves him, but more of him.
I'd be devastated to lose him. I'd be absolutely devastated to lose him. But if he goes to City, he won't be a starter there. I mean, of course, it'll improve his career. It will get him into the England squad. But he's got a lot of competition if he goes to City. Having said that, it might be that at City he gets far more protection than he would get at Palace. To be honest, I'm resigned to losing Eze. Wharton is the one I'd be devastated if we lost Wharton because Wharton's come to us and from Blackburn. And he looks like a Premier League player. From the first kick of his first game, he looked like a Premier League player.
Yeah.
His passing ability is fantastic. And he's the opposite of a luxury player. He's become the player you look for first on the team sheet. And it's almost like everything Eze does for us is a bonus. And again, it comes back to that conversation I had about it being our 12th season in the Premier League. We should be beyond... The fact it's like two seasons we had when if Zaha didn't play, we didn't win. We should be beyond that. We should be beyond going, if Eze's not fit, if Elise's not fit, we're not going to score goals. We shouldn't be in that situation. We should have bigger, better, stronger squads than we have. But we're definitely in a situation where you think, oh my God, if Wharton's not playing, we are in trouble because he brings us so much in the middle of the... He's a really old-fashioned... It reminds me a little bit of Geoff Thomas. He's a proper old-fashioned... box-to-box player, and he's almost more vital to the team than Eze. I mean, Eze's a feel-good player. You'll stand and applaud him more than you'll stand and applaud Wharton, but Wharton's the one you'll miss more if he's not in the team, I think.
Well, at least back on the bench tomorrow, though, which is...
he's been back on the bench for the last three games. You know the bloke in the pub who knows everything. The last three games, and Elise's definitely back. And if Elise is on the bench tomorrow, that would be a huge bonus for us because even Guardiola said that Elise somehow, he said his players were, when Olise came on against Stuart at the Etihad, somehow his players seemed scared of him. They just started to defend 5 yards. That's what Olise gives us when he's there. It's not the fact that he always does brilliant things when he's got the ball. It's just the fact that he's got that Zaha factor and that he makes defenders really wary. And the fact is that teams tend to double up on him, which then gives us that little bit of space. And I think there is a scenario when if we're still in the game. I mean, having said that, he gave away the penalty at Sellers Park last year when we were 5 minutes away from a 0-0 draw. If we're in the game with 10 minutes to go, bringing Olise on will make a massive change. I mean, because I think it will make you defend a little bit deeper and it will make you far more wary. And it will certainly if it's 10 minutes to go and you need to score, I think you'll be far more wary about committing men forward than you would be if Olise wasn't on the pitch. You see what I mean?
Yeah. My penultimate question was, how do you see the game playing out? But you kind of already answered that, and you're not sure.
I'm not sure.
A bit more defensive, I mean, obviously we'll have more of the ball, won't we? But as Glasner trying play basically to implement a team that has much more of the ball than you did under Roy Hodgson.
Well, having said that, much more of the ball than under Roy Hodgson still isn't that much more of the ball compared.
But it's, over 30%.
But he is still. I remember when Tony Pulis was manager, we beat Aston Villa 1-0. It was an evening game. And it took us out of the bottom three for the first time in about 6 weeks. And we had 32% possession, which we were very impressed by. And Keith Millen, our assistant manager, was on our pod the next night. And we were talking about the game. And we said, Keith, 32% possession. What luxury. And he said Pulis went absolutely mental at the team afterwards for having the ball for that long. He said, you can't cope with holding the ball. Yeah, we are trying to implement a more possession, but also using that possession to progress. Because Vieira tried to build a more possession-based style of football, but it wasn't progressive, if you see what I mean. Whereas Glasner's possession-based football is more progressive. He wants us to keep the ball but move it forward while keeping the ball. He wants to get the two wing-backs high up the pitch because he trusts the three centre-backs.
Yeah.
To do some the centre backs he likes, they've been passing the ball a lot more than our centre backs used to. He seems to really like Mateta. Mateta's turning into a really good old fashioned centre forward. You know, Roy Keane had his bizarre rant at the weekend about if he's not scoring goals, Haaland looks like a League Two striker.
He's got it in for all Haaland.
Of course, but Mateta is not scoring goals, but he's turned into, under Glasner, a really good, ironically, considering Hodgson's gone, Mateta has turned into a really good hold-up number nine. Hmm. He really battles well to win the ball and to bring other players into it. We are much more attacked, but I'm really intrigued to see whether tomorrow Glasner does try and encourage the centre back, the wing backs to get forward, in the hope that our three centre backs can cope with the fact that you're more possession. So I hope we don't revert to type and just sit in front of you for 80 minutes and watch you pass the ball around, because there's only one outcome of that inevitably. But at the same time, there's only one outcome if we go gung ho attack. The big fear tomorrow is Haaland at centre back, because if he plays, obviously you've got players that will score the goals if he doesn't play, but they're the sort of games where you miss someone like Damien Delaney, who's just a proper old school centre back, who you just go, right, you deal with Haaland, you wrestle him for the whole game and let the other team try and get on with Scott. So I really can't predict how it will play out tomorrow, and I'm actually very, very intrigued. I just hope we give you a game. That's the thing.
You generally give everyone a game, though, don't you?
If stopping other teams playing, it counts as giving you a game. Yeah,
There's many ways to play the game.
I agree with that. But we tend not to give teams too many problems going forward. Let's put it that way. And we again, this is a mentality we need to get out of. And several people said this to me last year, and I said, I'll take a 3-0 at Man City. We need to get out of that mentality of coming away from losing 2-0 at home to Arsenal going, well, that could have been worse.
We need
to get out. We already think Man United are not having a good season. Already, most Palace fans will be amazed. You know, if we come away with a point against, even after seeing Brentford outplay Man U last week, you know, if we come away with a point at Selhurst Park against Man United, we'll be going, oh, that's good. And we need, that mentality needs to change. It really does. And I'm one of the people who it needs to change. You know?
Just an aside, I interviewed David Bernstein a couple of weeks ago. His book's out, and he can't even watch Roy Keane on the TV because of that tackle. He's still so angry about it. Yeah.
Well, do you know what, as well? I interviewed Brian McClare, and we spoke about the Cantona thing, and Brian McClare, to his credit, really understood, and he said Cantona's behaviour was despicable. And Fergie, he said, we all had to get our stories straight afterwards because Fergie loved Cantona so much. But
that really, if
I was a City fan, I would turn Roy Keane off every time, because what most annoys us about the Cantona incident is what's happened with the Roy Keane thing, is that Cantona's being made a hero for it. Cantona's coming out of it as not the villain. And it's the same with, you know, people go, oh, good. That's the sort of player Roy Keane was. He did that to Haaland, and everyone going, you know, wasn't it funny when he stood over him saying, take that? No, it wasn't. He ended the man's career. You know. But Bernstein, what an interesting chap. We interviewed David Bernstein for The Price of Football.
Of course,
And some of that, I knew some of the details of what went on around that period. And I knew that there were 250,000 Man City fans at Wembley for the Gillingham game, but what an interesting story that Bernstein had to tell.
250,000 were on the hill at Blackburn when we got
promoted. Oh, so
it was 500,000 at Wembley. So.
But it is
now, obviously Liverpool would have taken more, but it was still
of course. But it's incredible when you talk to Bernstein about that era, where you are now, the progress that you've made in a relatively short space of time is absolutely astonishing. And the thing is, it won't happen again because there is no other Pep Guardiola out there. It's the same with Liverpool. Liverpool got to understand that the next manager they get won't be as good as Jurgen Klopp. They have to live with that, basically. The same as City have to understand the next manager they get won't be anywhere near as good as Pep Guardiola. It doesn't mean you won't win things, but you won't do it in a style that you're doing it now.
Having said that, you've probably not watched that Netflix documentary on City that's come out this week from the treble winning seasons. It was an in-house production that got the media very upset that an in-house production didn't go on about the 115 charges a lot. But I maintain to this day, when he's doing his speeches in the dressing room at halftime, no one understands a single word he's saying. Because I don't. I'd like to think I understand English quite well. There's no way they understand. He's just like, he's all over. Yeah. I hope the passion, goes on to them, but I'm sure all the tactical stuff is sorted out well away from that.
What he says at halftime doesn't matter. Just look at the man. He just looks cool, doesn't he? That's what you want from a manager.
Yeah.
I quite like the fact that Arteta gets, because Arteta can't even get angry as well as Guardiola does. Arteta gets, every time Arteta gets angry, he gets cool and he gets a yellow card, whereas Guardiola's much more subtle in his anger.
He don't want his hair to get out of place, would you, Arteta? Pep does not have that problem.
Arteta's hair is astonishing. It's one of those you can't take your eyes off.
Anyway, there's one important thing we need to discuss away from City and Palace. So I'll wrap this up and ask you, optional, go ahead, a heart score prediction for the game.
I think we had this conversation before. I'd rather not, but I've got a feeling we might score. Yeah. What I'll say is we don't keep many clean sheets. I think you'll win. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
That's as predicting, because I just know I worry that if we could highlight this, I'm convinced that every football club has one fan and it's their routine that counts. It's like, if we could find out which fan it was and make them keep the same routine every week, I'm convinced that we'd win every game. Well, but I worry that it's me, so I don't like to
every fan thinks it's themselves. Yeah. Well, I am an absolute pariah at the moment because I won't change my trainers during the season. and my right one is squeaking really badly. So I wear it for half an hour.
Yeah.
And nothing. And then, always when we leave the ground, even though we've been sat down, it starts squeaking. And honestly, I'm like, I'm sorry, everyone. I'm actually avoiding people in the street now because it makes such a huge squeak.
Well,
I can't see any holes in the thing, but I cannot change the trainers until the season ends. I mean, if we mathematically can't win the Premier League, I'll change my trainers, but otherwise...
Has it occurred to you, Howard, if you're not changing your trainers, it may be that other people are avoiding you?
Actually, yeah, but then if they've been squeaking for 20 years, that would make more sense. Yeah. But yes, I must cross the road at the top. I always go in the left turnstile. It's pathetic. It's so pathetic.
We have to get from the pub to the Palace... It's not that long a walk, but you have to know where you're going. But it takes you under a railway line, which is called the bunny. It's called the bunny hole, and we have to turn left out of the bunny hole. It takes you, you turn left. It's onto
that's 3 miles onto your trip.
It's exactly the same if you turn right and you turn left out of the bunny hole. But people get quite cross if we're turning left. People whose routine is to turn right will go, stop turning. That's the reason we're not doing well, because you keep turning right. Even the years we get relegated, you go, well, clearly turning left out of the bunny hole is not working, is it? But we still keep doing it.
I'm going to regret saying this, but it's like, always use the far right security check and the far right urinal in the ground. And I'm like, I was stuck there once having a pee going, what are you doing? It's just, and where did it start? Did I go to the toilet once and use that urinal? We once thought, oh, that's it now. Yeah. Sheikh Mansour took over City the week after just because of where I had a poo. So
we were once 2-0 down at home to Wolves, and this like the child of a friend of ours who was standing. That's how long ago it was. Standing sort of 5 yards away, this kid offered around some opal fruits, and we all took some opal fruits, and we won 3-2. So of course, well, we decided it was the opal fruit. So this poor kid, every game we played, had to give us all his opal fruits until we worked out that we weren't winning anymore. But the first two games afterwards we won, so obviously it was down to the opal fruits.
Yeah,
but then
form deteriorate when they changed the name to Starburst.
That's the trouble. You have to work out when you're tempting fate too far.
Yeah,
which is the game too far when you go, right, we've won 3 games of opal fruits, we can't take the piss out of the universe, we've got to find something different. But you go, no, let's keep with the opal fruits. Oh, we've lost 4-0, there you go.
Well, that's it. Maybe that's why Palace aren't challenging for those European places. You've got to go for more bespoke sweets, perhaps. I don't know. Take the risk and have a new sweet. Anyway, there is one thing I want to discuss left there. Obviously, as always, loving the price of football chat.
Thank you.
And was it John Blair? Have I got the name right?
The kit guy.
Really enjoyed that podcast you did last week.
Yeah.
So I just thought we'd end with a few minutes because I have kept you too long again. But are you, perhaps we all are, and this is the most stupid question you've probably ever been asked, are you a real kit nerd?
Was that
a special podcast for you to do as well?
Well, it was. The price of football is really frustrating at the moment, Howard, because we're talking so much about Everton and about Forest. And I just think it's... I'll keep this brief because I'm really angry about it. I think if we end up in a situation where Luton go down and Forest and Everton, who have gone beyond cheating, they haven't just bent the rules. If those two teams who cheated this season stay up and Luton go down, I'll be very cross. But the kit... What's frustrating about the kit pod is because producer Guy said, can we just keep it to the financial aspects of football kits? And because this guy, John Blair, is a collector and a trader in kits, an expert. So it was really frustrating not to just be able to have a conversation about kits, because I don't think any football fan's not obsessed with kits. I did a pod the other night with a chap called Richard Foster. He's got this new idea which is based around your first game. And it just so happens that he's a Palace fan, and we started talking about kits. And I'm not a huge fan of the white kit with the red and blue sash, which makes me a pariah.
Yeah, everyone loves a sash.
I love
City of City. David Silver, I think of him. White kit, sash.
We had an away kit, which was a light blue kit, oddly enough, with a red sash, which I absolutely love. But the white with the red. But if I ever, I'd have to be very rich. But if I ever got enough money to take over at Selhurst Park, the only reason I would do it is to make us change back to the best kit ever invented in the history of football in the world ever, which is our 1969 kit, which was the claret and light blues. Claret and light blues.
I've got them
stripes.
In front of me. I've got all your kits in front of me. A lot of yellow in there. A lot of yellow.
But that's the yellow, the claret and light blue stripe with the yellow collar. That's, I mean, it's partly to do with that's the time when you're becoming. I don't think any football fan is ever more obsessed than they are between the ages of 7 and 12. That's when you know everything. So that was my starter kit, if you like. But we've had some snazzy kit. But I think one of the reasons I've always, I was going to say liked Man City. I don't like any other club, but dislike them less than other clubs is because I've always loved the light blue kit. I think the light blue kit with the plain white trim is just the white, the round collar. I just think that's a great kit with that really intriguing badge as well. And I always loved the red and black away kit you had as well. You always had but I think I don't think there are many football fans. Although I don't know, I'd be interested to see whether, because younger fans are so exploited these days, because the kit's changed so often and because you've got four kits a year, I don't know. I'd be interested to see whether my son, who's 28, is as interested in kits as my generation is.
I probably guess no. I think it's a bigger thing.
I think also because there's I find it really odd as well. That's one of the things that I found odd when talking to this chap John Blair about kits is that, you know, people collect sponsors' names. They're as interested in a particular sponsor's name. It's like the Inter Milan kit with the ones with Pirelli on the front are worth far more than the ones with other sponsors. And he's saying the ones because they're sponsored by Paramount. Initially. So I guess there were, he's like the Palace, we were talking off air. He said the Palace shirt from the 90s sponsored by Virgin. He said that's a really collectible shirt as compared to the Brighton shirt with Nobbo on it, which no one wants to buy, obviously. But, you know, but it's really interesting that you've reached a certain age where people are nostalgic about shirt front sponsors, which I don't think younger fans now ever will be, partly because they change so much, although yours will probably be the same for a long time. But it's interesting.
Players,
Well, I think I think that's really interesting. He talked about that off air as well, is that there are collectors who will only trade replica shirts with certain players' names on the back. But also that's become a real phenomenon, particularly in Southeast Asia and in America, where you get football fans who will change a team. You know, they will support the team that Ronaldo plays for or Messi plays for. Their allegiance is to a particular player rather than to a particular club, which is a distressing concept as far as I'm concerned.
I know. No, but we did a podcast last week called If I Ruled the World. Do you know what you'd do if you... Well, speaks for yourself. And I didn't think of that. If I took over City, I'd be straight into the design bit, working out kits for the next 10 years. Yeah. Forget the season ticket prices or transfer targets. You'd be straight in and looking at a cracking kit for the next season, wouldn't you?
We got so excited when we did the book of the pod, the Price of Football book. When we had to design, we made up a team to follow from non-league through to Champions League, and we had to make up a kit. And Kieran and I it's the most excited we've ever been, because Bloomsbury, our publisher, said, well, it can't be, you know, you don't want to alienate fans by having it too red or too blue. So we had to find, so we ended up green and black. But just the fact we had to design an actual shirt, even for a made-up club, was just fantastic. And we had some Price of Football shirts made up for a charity thing, which Kieran, because Kieran's colourblind, wanted to be white. But we actually had these shirts made up by a proper shirt manufacturer, and going to the place where they made the shirts was just the trouble with shirts to come full circle, because we started talking about shirt prices. The trouble is, partly due to our podcast, I have to say, the trouble is that most football fans now know how much it costs to manufacture a shirt. They know that it at most it costs 12 quid. And at most, it will cost another fiver to fly it here from wherever the sweatshop is situated around the world. So they know how much the kit manufacturer and the clubs are adding to the price of the shirt, which is why they get so angry about the price. The price of the England shirt, never mind the manufactured argument about the Red Cross on the back. I think that just distracted from the fact that they were charging 150 quid for it. That's what the phone-ins on TalkSport should have been about.
Yeah, wouldn't go as viral, would they, if you had
that's a very good point. Yeah.
That's okay. I only wear kits to play badminton once a week. And I found Kappa kit. Yeah, the laser blue one City had, made up colour. You won't find it on any Dulux chart. I found it and I finally came to the realisation I'm never going to lose weight to fit back into that top. So I put it on eBay and it went for £90.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it was in good condition and it's still a popular one. So. Yeah. And it's not, it's not one that's been made since. It was bought at the time.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe it. I thought, there's no point in it hanging up in my cupboard. I'm never going to fit into it again. Absolutely ridiculous price. So it just goes to show, doesn't it? Definitely would get rid of the template. If I took over and ruled the world, get rid of templates, get rid of Nike, the same things. Have one every two seasons as well. And there was some plus points to the old days, was there not? Right. I definitely kept you enough, Kevin, so I will let you get off and enjoy your weekend. Well, hope you enjoy the second half of the weekend.
I'll enjoy Sunday, yeah.
Yeah, so thank you very much again for taking the time out to speak. Right. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure
and
talking to you, mate. All right.
Yeah, and as always, after tomorrow, good luck with the rest of the season.
And you, mate. All the best. Bye now.
All right, cheers. Thank you very much.